This is Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. This is part two of the book review of Cobalt Red, How the Blood of the Congo Powers Our Lives by Siddharth Kara, St. Martin's Press. It's an intense topic, so thank you. I appreciate people that have shared some comments. Feel free to do so. And here's part two.
Along with the labor issue, another obvious aspect is the natural world. Official estimates of the population of Kolwezi are around 600,000, but the true number is closer to 1.5 million. The city has been stretched beyond its limits. Ramshackle slums and makeshift villages spread out from city center into the ever-decreasing habitable space. Mines occupy at least 80% of the developed land in Kolwezi. The green is gone. Arable earth is extinct. A-R-A-B-L-E. Time-lapse satellite images of Kolwezi from 2012 to 2022 show that the brown around the city spread like a tsunami, devouring everything in its path. Kolwezi is the mangled face of progress in Africa. The hunt for cobalt is all. How ironic that the green is gone, and yet the green washing and the green revolution is what is the slick PR in the Western world. Baya said she first came to Kapata in 1977. She described Kolwezi as a quieter city in those days. People had space to live and food to eat. The air and water were clean. The villagers were poor, but they managed. We have a system called Kazi. This means you take a job with a company and they pay you a salary and give you food rations. They give you a home to live in and school for the children. That is how we came to Kapata. So that was the conditions before it got worse. And then some help is mentioned with one NGO working to, you know, to help the poor and the health and health care and such like. But then he interviews some other people and that's even iffy how much they're doing, but at least something is being done. Phrase that stood out to me is, let's see, pirate. If there was one face of this misery, one child debased by piracy cloaked as commerce. Piracy cloaked as commerce. And then the phrase that gets repeated, the global economy. This is a global economy thing. The global economy presses like a dead weight on the artisanal miners, crushing them into the very earth upon which they scrounge. And then a young woman who prostitutes herself to make money. The men in Congo hate women, she said. They beat us and laugh. My body is my marketplace. She said that prostitution and digging for cobalt were the same. Further on, it says that some would celebrate and use some of the money after mining for the prostitution, but not the soldiers. They would just do what they do. They would just take it without pay. And here's one of the gists of the disparity. Elodie was one of the most brutalized children I met in the DRC. She had been thrown to a pack of wolves by a system of such merciless calculation that it somehow managed to transform her degradation into shiny gadgets and cars sold around the world. Now that's an earlier section, which I think sums up also another summary of the contrast, the disparity, from toxic pit to shiny showroom. So there it is. That's the slick, you know, when you go, a couple years ago, I got a new used car and yeah, it's nice to see the shiny curves and the this and that, but I didn't get it for that. The seduction and the level of seduction when people go shopping is just a testament to the disparity and the hypocrisy. And the red dirt on the photo on the cover is of the title Cobalt Red refers to also the red dirt, which shows many of the Congolese with shovels and a steep hillside, which is dangerous. And many people fall and hurt themselves. Many people get crushed in the tunnels where they dig. But the red is for the blood of some of the people that have died, which he describes in the beginning. And then I think the red is also for the earth and just the blood, the energy it takes to run that system and the families. There's also mention that in 2014, some kind of vein of the cobalt, which I think most of it comes from some rock, it's called heterogenite. And it was like the gold rush in California. Somebody found it in 2014, and that started the madness. So this makes me think in the big picture, what is it about humanity? What is it about the human consciousness that whatever it is, somebody found gold, somebody found cobalt, and suddenly there's just a madness, an insane madness, the word rush, which in a way reflects our society. The everybody's in a rush to survive, in a rush to make it. That madness I would be best described by the Jack Forbes book, Columbus and Other Cannibals, the Wetiko, which is a native word for just rapacious greed and insanity, like a cannibal. And there's also a Chinese guy who said, China is too competitive. Someone like me cannot advance in China. Africa is a big place. It is not so competitive. We find opportunities here. So he's away from his family for almost the entire year, except for Lunar New Year, because it's supposedly better for him there. Then there's a town, Musompo's function seemed to be little more than a massive centralized laundering mechanism for artisanally mined cobalt into the formal supply chain. So that again is mentioned, how all this under the radar and lack of paperwork of the artisanal mining is, it just makes the supply chain, you know, gives them alibis and makes it unrecordable. And also the artisanal cobalt has a higher grade than cobalt mined mechanically. So it is necessary for the mining industry to have artisanal mining. So that's part of the reason why the shovels and the hand picked is because of it's more cobalt, higher grade, more money. And here's a section about the gold rush. On January 24th, 1848, a sawmill operator in Coloma, California, named James Marshall, spotted a nugget of gold in a riverbed. News spread quickly, and treasure seekers from across the country flocked to California in search of riches. They ripped up hills, chopped down trees, dammed rivers, and burrowed thousands of mine shafts into the Sierra Nevada mountains. Hydraulic mining was the technique of the day, involving the use of high-powered water jets that ripped away entire hillsides. The environmental and humanitarian damage caused by the gold rush was substantial. California's agricultural sector was hard hit by dammed rivers and mining runoff. Indigenous people were evicted from land upon which they had lived for generations wherever gold deposits were found. Violence between locals and prospectors flared. The land became a lawless frontier of crime and bedlam. So that's fast forward to the town called Casulo, 2014. A local resident was digging a well next to his home when he found a hunk of heterogenite that turned out to have a staggering 20% grade of cobalt, higher than anywhere else in the world. The inhabitants of Casulo promptly took hold of every shovel, spade, and piece of rebar they could find and started digging tunnels all over the neighborhood. People flocked en masse to Casulo to join the scramble for blue gold. Locals were displaced, the earth was despoiled, and conflict erupted. There are no precise figures to show how many tunnels there are in Casulo, but locals estimate over 2,000. In April 2017, Governor Mudiev awarded a purchasing monopoly to Congo Dangfang Mining for all the cobalt in Casulo in exchange for a payment of $12 million. And that's when it gets into the, quote, awarded rights and the mining and the companies and the kickbacks and the corporate foreign mining and the government and the fascism and the collusion and the mafioso tactics and all that stuff, all because of the money factor and the madness. And here's the town, one of the worst places. Casulo is the new sore in the heart of Africa. The neighborhood is a manic hive of tunnels that swarm with desperate and intoxicated diggers who stare death in the face each day. Everyone who digs in Casulo lives in mortal fear of being buried alive. It is a neighborhood of concentrated hazard and the distillation of the entire system of cobalt mining in the Congo. All the madness, violence, and indignity culminate here. Casulo is also the face of everything that is wrong with the global economy. Nothing matters here but the resource. People and environment are disposable. And later on, the Kosala was walled off for precisely this reason. No one must uncover the truth. And that is why there are guards and army that patrol these places. So that is, again, a tip of the hat to Siddharth Kara, the author, who investigative reporter journalism found out this stuff. No one must uncover the truth, and here he is doing the best he can, and some of it's probably worse than he could even report. But that's the madness right there. That is nothing new. The destruction of the environment and the people and any sense of communal getting along and community and cooperation, all for the God Almighty buck, which runs the whole system. And one thing that stood out to me, also another example of the disparity. Tunnel diggers risk their lives for the prospect of riches. Mind you, the, quote, richest income I documented in Kosala was an average take-home pay of $7 per day. There are spikes to 12 or even 15 when a particularly rich vein of heterogenite is found. This is the lotto ticket everyone is after. The most fortunate tunnel digger in Kosala earned around $3,000 per year. By way of comparison, the CEOs of the technology and car companies that buy the cobalt mined from Kosala earn $3,000 in an hour. And they do so without having to put their lives at risk each day that they go to work. Being intoxicated was how most of the diggers in the neighborhood dulled the dread of descending into the tunnels. That is just freaking outrageous. You know, people know that from reading the news. The disparity of wealth is just, it's at insane proportions, worse than it's ever been. But yet, there's that equation. The consumers that are buying into the slickness of the technology and the cars without the awareness of where it comes from. So again, I am reminded of the chef. Would you go into a restaurant if right before you were being served your delicious meal, you heard screaming and you found out that the chef was being whipped? That is what this is like. That to me is an example, a comparison. But that is essentially literally. So again, we have this out of sight, out of mind consciousness that pervades the world and the global economy. And that's one of the things that needs to be addressed. The other thing that stood out to me too is the whole that mentions this is the rechargeable battery market. Now, many years ago when I first learned to meditate, that was some of how I learned of it, that after a long busy day, I was feeling tired and depleted of energy, and how could I possibly have enough energy the next day is what it felt like. But then, meditate and sort of recharge the battery. So I don't know what that says, except that I'm trying to think of the metaphor here, but we've become addicted as a world society has become addicted to you can just plug it in and recharge it. But that recharging is at a cost. And then the bigger question, are we sacrificing, where is the recharging of our own innate energies? Where is the recharging of, as many people recommend, walking barefoot and standing with the earth and literally getting the vibrations and energy from the Mother Earth? That is recharging. So however you recharge your holistic body, mind, spirit battery, that is what we need more of, I think. We become lazy. We just plug it in and recharge it. But that recharge comes at a cost. And if we're doing that and not recharging our own essence, our own spirits, then we are being slowly sucked of humanity consciousness and spiritual consciousness and becoming slaves to the gadgets and the energy that runs the gadgets. So I don't know that there's any happy medium. It seems like extreme measures need to happen to make genuine change. So wrapping up with the last about 25, 30 pages of the book, some of the economics, assuming an average 4% grade and price of roughly $1.30 per kilogram, The team members earned an average of about $5.20 per day after a 60-40% split with their sponsor, which would increase to $6.50 per day once the split moved to 50-50. This is the highest average income of any artisanal cobalt miners I documented in the DRC. And now this next bit is, I think, one of the key things in the whole book. It's part of why when I read, I consider it like, you know, no metaphorical pun intended, panning for gold and finding the very interesting bit. So I'm going to read this paragraph first. These numbers also suggest that the aggregate cobalt production from Kasulo is massive. If each digger produced roughly 250 kilograms of heterogenite per month and there were 18,000 tunnel diggers in Kasulo, then the neighborhood would produce 54,000 tons of heterogenite per year. There are thought to be somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 tons of heterogenite under Kasulo. So at best, the scramble has another 10 or 15 years to run. A lot of money by Congolese standards will be made by Kasulo's tunnel diggers during that time. Countless lives will be lost. When the cobalt finally runs dry, the world will carry on and leave Kasulo behind, just like a lion that has finished gorging. This is the, quote, disaster, end quote, that Gloria, the student in Lubumbashi, warned about. Once the resources have been looted, the Congolese people will be left with nothing but worthless dirt and empty stomachs. In the interim, the prospect of earning $5 or $10 a day beckoned thousands of diggers like Mutombo into the tunnels. The global economy depended on it. Mutombo's daily descent created value denoted in the billions of dollars for everyone up the chain, yet only he and those like him assumed all the risk. The system was all upside for everyone but Mutombo, and the riches he created were stacked to the sky atop his earnest shoulders. So there's one of the key things now, is that the shelf life. So this is saying that 10 or 15 years. So now there's a huge push for the electric vehicles. I saw something online about $1,000 credit from the government or something if you get your electric vehicle, whatever. So the push is huge. So considering that in 10 or 15 years, I don't know what the rest of the world cobalt supply is like, but say that in so many years there won't be enough cobalt for all the gadgets, what that tells me is that, and this is my prediction from this, that in 10 or 15 years, like if stuff doesn't change, then there's going to be something else. There's going to be another push. It'll go from electric vehicles to something else. I don't know what. But the shelf life of the cobalt tells me that something else is up the sleeve. And in the chapter, one of the most poetic moments in the book, he's describing the cobalt. I reached into the sack and picked up a fist-sized chunk of heterogenite. It looked similar to that first chunk I held in Kipushi, a beguiling mix of teal and azure, speckles of silver splashed with orange and reddish patches. The colors in this specimen were deeper and richer. This was some of the highest grade cobalt ore in the world, and it was everywhere under Kasulo, waiting to be discovered like raisins in a cake. And then he talks about this boy, Mutombo. I think a boy, Mutombo, it was just before he had talked with him, and then he's going underground into the tunnels. Mutombo grasped my hands tightly before he descended, our eyes locked in a moment of shared understanding. Although I would never see him again, we were forever linked by the flow of stones from his world to mine. From his world to mine, I watched Mutombo creep down the tunnel. Just before the shadows took him, he looked at me and smiled, like the moment light first fell upon the earth. Aside from the beautiful image, it in a harsh situation, is just something about that stirred me that, you know, even in the most dire situation, there are some people that just maintain their smile and maintain their, it's what they got to do. And several people, when in the book, when asked about, you know, the safety and this and that, you know, being under the mines, they say, well, it's in God's hands, so they just didn't think about it too much. There's also a section talking about the difference between the Congolese and the Chinese that don't seem to get along too well, different work ethics. And again, the conundrum of disparity. I am not aware of any conferences about cobalt mining at the OECD in Paris or at UN headquarters in Geneva and in New York that included artisanal miners at the table. For that matter, I doubt that many people, if any, who participate in these conferences have ever visited an artisanal mining site in the Congo and spoken to the people who work there. The same goes for the CEOs of major tech and car companies that buy Congolese cobalt. Meaningful solutions cannot be devised if they are devoid of direct input from those the solutions are meant to assist. This is particularly true in the Congo, where the voices on the ground tell a very different, if not antithetical, story to the one told at top. He mentions before that, advancing the ability of the Congolese people to conduct their own research and safely speak for themselves is the first step to solving the calamities taking place in the mining provinces of the DRC. Incorporating their voices in convenings on how to improve their lives should seem obvious, but it rarely happens. And profits up the chain were as great as ever as cobalt prices increased throughout 2021, but incomes for artisanal miners reached rock bottom. This was during the peak of the COVID pandemic. Families could no longer afford food, clothing, and housing. Thousands of children had to leave school to dig for cobalt to help their families survive. So that's part of it. That's part of the no choice that these people have to survive. And then someone asked a simple question. This is a nun who asked the question, how can a sustainable future be built through sacrificing the very bearers of that future, through depriving children's well-being, and worse even, through depriving children the right to be? Although conditions for the Congo's artisanal miners have worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic, there is a realistic path forward to alleviate most, if not all, of the harms they are suffering. The path begins with accountability. The biggest problem faced by the Congo's artisanal miners is not the gun-toting soldiers, unscrupulous Chinese buyers, exploitative mining cooperatives, or collapsing tunnels. These and other antagonists are but symptoms of a greater menace. The biggest problem faced by the Congo's artisanal miners is that stakeholders up the chain refuse to accept responsibility for them, even though they all profit in one way or another from their work. Rather than issue vacant statements on zero tolerance policies and other hollow PR, corporations should do the one simple thing that would truly help: treat the artisanal miners as equal employees to the people who work at corporate headquarters. If major technology companies, EV manufacturers, and mining companies acknowledge that artisanal miners were an integral part of their cobalt supply chains and treated them with equal humanity as any other employee, most everything that needs to be done to resolve the calamities currently afflicting artisanal miners would be done. Many of the solutions that are put forward, he says, are like flash in the pan initiatives. It sounds good, but then when the attention goes off of that, then the initiatives for better fair treatment they disappear. So that's, you know, that's something to be skeptical of when you read of quote solutions. From my perspective, the one thing lacking in the book would be discussing on the bigger picture less usage. So while obviously he puts forth a good simple solution in fair treatment and considering the artisanal miner like the CEO, fair treatment and equity would do much to dispel the conundrum of disparity. But the other thing on the broader picture is, what about less usage of all the addiction for the mining, for the gadgets? So then the question raises, well, how would these kids, you know, earn money? But that, you know, that gets into a whole nother, that whole discussion about, you know, them being able to afford school and other jobs. So the whole system in that way is connected. But I think in the big picture, less usage is one thing that's rarely discussed. And I've heard that mentioned many times, that in all these solutions and so-called sustainable and so-called green, the topic of less usage is not mentioned enough. It's instead trying to transfer the supply of energy and the resources into a different mineral or a different model, but it doesn't solve the deeper problem. So more choices for the people in the Congo, that is, I think, a top priority. And then at least currently, fair treatment. And the book ends with Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, who was had mentioned earlier in this review, and it's mentioned in the book, at some point when he was the glimpse of change in the Congo, he was assassinated. So the book ends as such. One final voice calls to us from the Congo. The nation's greatest freedom fighter and first prime minister, Lumumba, described his dreams for the future of the country in his final missive to his wife, Pauline, just before he was assassinated. One can imagine the letter being addressed equally to the Congo itself. Lumumba's dream was tragically snuffed out by those who would let nothing stand between them and their scramble to loot the country's resources. Such has been the Congo's nightmare for centuries. My beloved companion, I write you these words not knowing whether you will receive them, when you will receive them, and whether I will still be alive when you read them. Throughout the struggle for the independence of my country, I have never doubted for a single instant that the sacred cause to which my comrades and I have dedicated our entire lives would triumph in the end. But what we wanted for our country, its right to an honorable life, to perfect dignity, to independence with no restrictions, was never wanted by Belgian colonialism and its Western allies, who found direct and indirect, intentional and unintentional support among certain high officials of the United Nations, that body in which we placed all our trust when we called on it for help. They have corrupted some of our countrymen. They have bought others. They have done their part to distort the truth and defile our independence. What else can I say? That whether dead or alive, free or in prison, by order of the colonialists, it is not my person that is important. What is important is the Congo. Our poor people, whose independence has turned into a cage, with people looking at us from outside the bars, sometimes with charitable compassion, sometimes with glee and delight. But my faith will remain unshakable. I know and feel in my heart of hearts that sooner or later my people will rid themselves of all their enemies, foreign and domestic, that they will rise up as one to say no to the shame and degradation of colonialism and regain their dignity in the pure light of day. We are not alone. Africa, Asia, and the free and liberated peoples in every corner of the globe will ever remain at the side of the millions of Congolese who will not abandon the struggle until the day when there will be no more colonizers and no more of their mercenaries in our country. I want my children, whom I leave behind and perhaps will never see again, to be told that the future of the Congo is beautiful and that their country expects them, as it expects every Congolese, to fulfill the sacred task of rebuilding our independence, our sovereignty. For without justice there is no dignity, and without independence there are no free men. Neither brutal assaults, nor cruel mistreatment, nor torture have ever led me to beg for mercy, for I prefer to die with my head held high, unshakable faith, and the greatest confidence in the destiny of my country, rather than live in slavery and contempt for sacred principles. History will one day have its say. It will not be the history taught in the United Nations, Washington, Paris, or Brussels, however, but the history taught in the countries that have rid themselves of colonialism and its puppets. Africa will write its own history, and both north and south of the Sahara will be a history full of glory and dignity. Do not weep for me, my companion. I know that my country, now suffering so much, will be able to defend its independence and its freedom. Long live the Congo. Long live Africa. So it's an uplifting bit there, but I also want to mention a couple of other bits to mention what he's fighting for. Earlier, a few pages before that, the author writes, "But hope in the Congo is like a hot coal. Take hold and it will scald you to the bone." And then he also mentions this tragedy. 63 men and boys were buried alive in a tunnel collapse at Kamilombe on September 21st, 2019. Only 4 of the 63 bodies were recovered. The others would remain forever interred in their final poses of horror. No one has ever accepted responsibility for these deaths. The accident has never even been acknowledged. This was the final truth of cobalt mining in the Congo. The life of a child buried alive while digging for cobalt counted for nothing. All the dead here counted for nothing. The loot is all. So that's as blunt as it could be put, and that made me realize what I already know in my life, but it reaffirmed, even if I cannot make that much change to this whole story, this whole true life story, it reminded me of what is the essential and what is the most important in living is not the loot. It's the care for the people, the care for fair treatment, for equality with as the natives say, all the relations, the land, the air, the water, the birds, the fish. This is what is being totally ignored by the powers that bank and those that perpetrate these crimes. They are crimes that are perpetrated for the benefit of the slick lifestyle, these slick gadgets that many feel we have no choice but to have. But that's the conundrum that I would ask people to ponder, would be to, you know, how to deal with that. And I'll just read some of the most beautiful acknowledgments I've ever read in a book. Really heartfelt. He thanks his wonderful agent. He could not have a better editor. Various people who gave comments and research, sort of humorously, he said he thanked people for helping him understand the geology of cobalt and the copper belt, which was no small feat, considering that the starting point was someone who did not know the difference between a mineral, a rock, and an ore. And he thanks his, family members and other writers. A special debt to Adam Hochschild. I admired him long before we met, and when he kindly responded to a random email from me, I was over the moon with anticipation to meet him. He persuaded me at our first of several sushi lunches in Berkeley that I had to write this book, and he suggested the way I needed to tell this story. He is a cherished mentor and encouraged me every step of the way. His quote is on the front of the book. He's the author of King Leopold's Ghost. And then at the beginning, the acknowledgments, the people most important to this book, those for whom my gratitude cannot be measured, are the ones who cannot be named without putting them and their families at risk. This book would not exist without the assistance of numerous guides and translators who facilitated my investigations deep into the mining areas of the Congolese Copper Belt. I am forever grateful to them. I am deeply indebted as well to every Congolese person who bravely shared their stories with me, the children, the fathers, the widows, the orphans, and the mothers who beat their chests. I will not forget the promises I made to you. So it's really a heartfelt report story that he presents in the book. It's wonderfully written. It was one of those I could not put down, read through it rather quickly. It has that forward motion of finding out what's happening as he travels. It's a wonderful blend of information and emotion. Obviously, the personal stories are meant to affect the reader and to put the contrast in stark daylight. So for those of you who can handle that kind of reading of such intensity, it's a strongly recommended. And thank you for listening, and be well.